How are you, Steve?
I'm not bad, thank
Yeah.
you.
Can you just spend a few words on how did you start the label? And I mean, it was originally like a blog or a webzine about UK-based music and some theoretical writings about it. So what was your motive or contingency at the time to start a label, and what choices did you make at the beginning?
Well, you're right. I started Hyperdub as a web magazine around about 2000. And this is also the time that music blogs were in their golden age, where writers were able to, without having an editor, like think on the page without limit, also without pay, which is can be a liberating and an oppressive thing simultaneously. So the idea was to do this is also the time of the digital music explosion, MP3s, Napster, and so on. So the idea was to have a kind of web magazine that specifically focused on, I suppose, the Jamaican influence on electronic music in UK, a particular lineage from, let's say, jungle to garage and onward. So this is before dubstep existed. So that was the musical remit. So the one of the initial ideas was to, this is a period when there was a lot of global websites, such as mp3.com, which were, people weren't buying music digitally in that time, but there was a movement to like facilitate musicians to be able to digitally distribute their own music without an intermediary. Well, with the intermediary being a website. So, you upload your music and it allows you to promote your music worldwide immediately. And there was a lot of sites which are purporting to do that for anyone, anywhere. So part of our initial idea was to do something like that, but with a local focus. There's a lot of amazing, very active music culture in London, specifically South London. And so the question was, what would it be to approach this global digital, this changing digital planet from a local point of view, as
So like
opposed
a
to
global platform for a local scene.
to provide a global platform for a local scene, exactly, as opposed to a global platform for a bunch of isolated individuals who could be anywhere.
And
So there was the idea was to do some editorial work around that by working with my favorite music writers such as Simon Reynolds, Kodjo Esha, and Mark Fisher, and also to just tap into the musicians that were around me to start with. And when we started Hyperdub as a web magazine, for example, we do small Hyperdub nights, or we did some nights at the ICA in the center of London. And one of those artists who were around, who were doing nights, was with the artist currently known as Actress. But there's a scene going on anyway, regardless of what we were doing. So we just wanted to provide an editorial platform for that music that wasn't limited into these kind of press release style bullshit journalism that you would find in Mixmag or DJ Mag or any of the mainstream dance music press. So they'll be able to do interviews and features without word length.
and were you consciously aiming to be innovative in a way? Did you think your music was new in itself? Like we are new compared to what this magazine, these outlets, these sounds that were around at the time.
Not necessarily. I think the feeling was more that this lineage of music, which Simon Reynolds would call the hardcore continuum, for example, had the ability to, every few years, both formally and socially, innovate a new scene. Now, obviously, these scenes were part of a lineage, so it's kind of like a generational thing, but this is also the music that I've been DJing. This is the the current of music that I've been following for the 10 or so years prior to that. So I'm like, as a DJ, I've always felt like, or at least in that period, surfing on a wave or surfing on a current of which every few years there was a new wave.
Okay.
So Hyperdub was a way of, like, I suppose, tuning in to these waves, and trying to, you know, someone from my background in, let's say, philosophy, try to not just tune in to the musical dimension of that wave, but also the conceptual dimension of that wave.
Yeah, and how do you understand the concept of innovation as a musical practice? Is it like breaking free from tradition, or just riding the crest of a wave that's already pushing you in a way somewhere? It's bringing you somewhere together with the scene.
I don't think there's a simple, like, my relationship to futurism, let's say, is a problematic one, because I don't really subscribe to this idea of a linear history in which you break from a tradition and leave it in the past and you speed off into the future, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think it's a more spiraling process, and where, you know, when something new happens, it's constantly eating and digesting and regurgitating the past. What's new about it might be something that's added technologically. You know, maybe there's aspects of technology, not all of it, that does have a sense of progress. Technology that we're working with now didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. And that leaves a mark on the social scenes. You know, generationally, there's some sense of development. Obviously, young people succeed older people, and that moves forward. There's something similar that happens with technology. Musically, it's more complicated than that. Culturally, it's more complicated than that. And there's a, you know, that this is where I think that the relationship between the past, present, and the future is more convoluted than a linear history can allow us to understand. So it's never a clear break with tradition for me.
But wasn't there a bit of like an avant-garde ideology, at least in the early Detroit techno scene, was deliberate break from tradition, even from the city's own tradition, musical tradition in a way. So was that, you think, like the last occurrence of a popular music avant-garde?
No, because I don't think that was like an avant-garde move in a like Western modernism type of avant-garde move. You know, you can't see Detroit techno devoid of Parliament, Kraftwerk, Motown. You know, it's part of that. It's part of the history of Afro-American music. But what is different is the post-industrial status of Detroit. Digital drum machines, synthesizers, the 808, and so on. That's what allowed it to be a break from the past. The chronology of these things is multi-layered. One is technological, one is music cultural, one is social, one is economic, you know, and they don't all, I think it's the technological that makes it the break from the past, only in the sense that those technologies didn't exist in the 60s.
I think that both in avant-garde, like in common practice avant-garde, and in popular music, artists, composers, musicians, DJs, in a way, they always kind of, you mentioned you were riding a wave, but that wave has some ideology in it. And I mean ideology in a positive way, in the sense that artists need to believe in the value of their own work. Otherwise, they wouldn't make it. They need ideology to believe in some intrinsic intellectual, spiritual, social, humanistic value of the musical world they're building with their practice. But each innovation involves also some sort of disrespect of an old generation. Could be your own father, or could be the music that you were forced to study instead of the music you would have wanted to study. So do you think we can still have, in a way, this relationship with future? You mentioned it was spiraling. I mean, is this also some sort of positive ideology in the sense, okay, I can write the future by digging the past and configuring it in a different way? Or is that what you meant?
Yeah, I don't think there's a contradiction between generations drawing a line and saying fuck you to the previous generation and giving a new name to what they're doing and stealing sounds from previous generations and saying, this is ours. We don't care. We stole it from you. This is ours now. Well, this is the way we do it. I don't think there's a contradiction between that kind of sense of breaking with the past and the idea that time is more spiraling. Because each time you draw a line and you say fuck you to the past, it's almost like you go onto a new ring of the spiral. So I think you're right. I think there's each of these stages, whether it be Detroit techno or jungle, there is like an ideology of innovation and forward movement and escape and all of these kind of ideas of starting from year zero. But there's never a blank slate, is there? We don't.
Yeah, I agree. And this makes me think of world building, which is something you've been doing in your records and your overall practice, and specifically on future world building, because on sonic fiction, we can call it as well. I think it's part of the same larger process or continuum of a desire of capturing reality and kind of controlling it by building a world that you actually are, you know, you keep it at a distance in a way, you put it in a fictitious world and like in a science fiction universe or like a space colony, as you have done in some of your records. I don't want to use the word ideology too much. This is also a sort of ideology. It's like, okay, I don't like the world today, the situation I'm in, it's kind of pretty grim, so I build another world. But the world I'm building is not necessarily a better world.
Well, probably the place to start with that is to like to understand what science fiction is, which is not really about the future. It kind of is, but it's also about reimagining the present. And so you do, maybe science fiction sometimes does that through projecting future scenarios, but really it's about trying to rethink the short-term future or recast the future in a way which maybe dramatizes some of the bad things that are about it that are going on, or recasts it in a way to find some escape routes out of the present. You know, whether it's a scene saying fuck you to the past or it's like an elaborate science fictional scenario or world, or some kind of understanding that the present is weirder than any future dystopia situation we could imagine. I think they're all ways of like an expression of a dissatisfaction with the present, and a kind of thinking through how to escape. An eschatological drive as opposed to an escapist drive.
Okay.
You know, like Houdini, like you're tied up in chains and you have to work out how to disentangle yourself from a trap, as opposed to how can I imagine like a little fantasy world to escape into for the weekend, whereby I have to return to reality on Monday. You know, that's where I'd make it. Conceptual difference between like escapology and escapism. Yeah, so I think there's an escapological drive behind world building, imagining future scenarios, drawing a line between the present and tradition.
In these future worlds that you're building with sonic fictions often, they contain many allegories of the future that someone else thought of, usually decades ago, you know, like space colonies, for instance, and stuff like that. So are we also not just building a world, are we also like playing or replaying an archive of allegories that's already available? Like we're digging a crate of allegories of the future instead of coming up with new ones.
There's certainly some piss-taking going on and some satire going on. With most of my projects, there's some humor happening for sure. certainly with escapology, I'm not really talking about Scottish independence as escaping to a space colony. I am making a connection between what I found was hilarious, that there's a space race going on, an actual space race going on in the north of Scotland, and the history of the UK, and the founding of the UK and an imagined end of the UK, and the video game like situation of like trying through democratic means to get independence. And you know, it's a decades old desire,
mm-hmm.
you know, 50, 60 years, I think, since at least the 70s. And sometimes it looks futile. Sometimes it gets closer to reality, but something you wonder if it's what's more likely, this political outcome or escaping to a space colony. You know, sometimes it seems as far away from the science fictional, the retrofuturist scenario of the 70s of escaping to these orbital space colonies. Likewise, in my last album in 2015, Nothing, the fictional world that we created with Lawrence Leck, the simulation artist, was a kind of satire on ideas that were floating around at that moment, both in a right-wing context and in a left-wing context, of kind of fully automated AI-driven societies. So we created this idea of the Notel. The Notel is a fully automated luxury hotel, which was a play on this idea of fully automated luxury communism, but a luxury communism that had been appropriated by a Chinese hotel chain and turned into a luxury hotel chain for the elite. And so this weird right and left wing appropriation and reappropriation, and so it was a hotel chain in which everything was, all the work was done by drones, except for some reason that's not stated, there's no rich humans left to enjoy this privacy, luxury, security, and so on. So the question was, what are all these worker drones going to do liberated from labor? Which is an old question. But playing out, you know, it's a question that's still very current in discussions of AI and work and technological society and so on. So there's an element of piss-taking going on in both of these projects.
Isn't this idea of the liberated worker, does it come into play with the experience of early rave parties in a way? It's like we're liberated from, I don't know, the city and the ties that city brings with it. It can become a music scene in a way, like a music king scene more than a music scene. And I've heard you speak of the cycle of these music scenes, that music scenes, they can become not so much alive, but more like undead. Can you explain me a bit what you mean by undead in this case?
Yeah, I'm always struck, you know, if you follow the different waves of these music scenes and the wave of excitement which accompanies the sense of like you're rushing into the future and something new is happening, and then the period of stabilization and becoming, you know, these are kind of ecological cycles of innovation, stagnation, decline. But even when you say a scene has stagnated, it's still going on and it still could be even bigger than it ever was. Techno, for example. You know, techno's been around for a long time. It's bigger than it ever was. The rate of innovation is, if we just talk about the genre of techno as opposed to all of electronic dance music, the rate of innovation is very slow, if at all. So the idea of the undead is, it's like, it's kind of the genre lives on even after it's in terms of innovation, has died. The genre, in a way, keeps growing, and as it winds its way into like new generations and kind of more mainstream audiences, it may be bigger than ever, but there's something about the period of innovation, which is its liveliest period, in a way, or its most, where it's most dynamic and most full of potential. It's when the undead nature of scenes, why do they only last? Why does it feel like the period of potential is so short-lived? Like, why do scenes burn out? Well, it seems like an ecological process of the lifespans, where each musical scene, formally and socially, has a life cycle. And there's waves, again, there's waves of new life forms which supersede previous ones. And it's not that the previous ones disappear. They often go into kind of a latent state where, instead of spreading to a mainstream audience, they just stay with the hardcore of a scene. That scene may appear dormant from the outside, but it's carrying on quite happily within. And it might, as often happens with the generational movement, it might suddenly get reactivated 10 years in the future and start spreading again. And, you know, Jungle's a good example of that, where there was a moment of explosion in the early 90s. It mutated into drum and bass. It became a global phenomena. Then it kind of retreated a bit and just focused on itself, the global networks that it had established, but you wouldn't see it in the charts anymore. And then, you know, 20 years later, a new generation enters into it and finds a way of making it spread into the mainstream again, whether it be Pink Panther-esque or Nia Archives or someone like this. And then, so the idea of the undead is really just trying to understand how scenes go through these life cycles and carry on outside of the spotlight, maybe without innovation, but just treading water, ticking over, potentially to be reactivated in the future.
But do you think that the experience of going to a party in the early 90s and the sense that you are part of a wave that was preparing you to the future, carrying you to some future, in one of those shorter waves of innovation, that compared to now, how would that experience be unique, that time and place? Aren't the experience of the new generation rediscovering Jungle today just as unique and kind of, they have the same meaning to them? Are we not idealizing so much our own, in a way, experience of being at the place of time where we think it's unique, and someone who's doing it now is just part of an undead scene or just part of a revivalist scene? How do we tell the difference?
I suppose, weirdly, the definition of the scene being alive, or the period of full potential, when it's an embryonic, when it's like an egg, is full of potential. The potential is partly a social thing, but the key is the technology being new. So there's a whole world, a technological world to explore. That's the difference now. With, if you take a scene that's 20 years old, obviously there's potential in that musical form exploring new technologies, but that might make it another, if it's truly innovative, that's going to become a different musical form. It's not just going to be technologically updated permutations of a musical form. So that would be the difference. I think you're right socially, but technologically, that would be the key difference between Jungle in the early 90s and Jungle now, for example. Specifically, you know, things like time stretching, the technological approaches which made Jungle a distinct line in a historical line.
What's your take on archives? Do you think they have more to do with the accumulation of knowledge and power, or are they more like, in a way, a neutral container of scenes, experiences, and artifacts?
I think archives are like part of this process of humans the human brain spreading out into the world.
Extended mind.
Extended mind, prosthetic, you know, it's a prosthetic process. Or from the other point of view, it's like a global network extracting knowledge from humans. Like this knowledge machine, you could see it like a Skynet type thing, where this knowledge, this information entity has used humans up to this point, human brain up to this point, to get to this point in history. It's to use humans to establish a global technological network, which has enabled the knowledge to become autonomous from the human brain. Okay. So the archive, like a global archive, I see it, I suppose I see it as this kind of, maybe a bit like this idea of the noosphere, of like this global brain, which is now more than human, and obviously has an agency that's more than human, for better or for worse. It just is, you know, it's humans have facilitated this, but the impact of this kind of extended mind is kind of beyond the control of humans by this point. So I always thought of, you know, one way in relation to music, the internet is just a massive, from a musician's point of view, it's a massive sample bank, but it's more than that. It's an some kind of entity which is kind of uses humans to assemble it, is using humans to assemble it.
The knowledge that's stored in this archive is not, it's not just stored there, it's not inert. It continues to function and it transforms itself as well, because I think that's also one of the peculiar affordances or side effects of this type of Skynet-like archives, because it's before you find something in an archive, it's an artifact, you can transform the meaning of it through historical interpretation, or you place it in the present, or maybe you decide it's not worth being there, you destroy it because it's fake, it's false, it's not, you know. So you change the archive in this way. Now it's a bit like the other way around. Historically founded artifacts are used to generate fictitious or historically unfounded narratives in a way.
Yeah, I suppose now we're in a new phase of the archive where, like you said, the archive is, well, the archive's always been generative, but it's been, AI makes the archive generative in a whole new way, where, you know, through being able to analyze big data, like huge databases, this is like a soil for growing things that have never existed. And that's genuinely new, isn't it? You know, certainly the cult before the digital, like the cultural archive that we carry within us in our memory, has always been like a soil for generating new culture. But what's different is the generation doesn't need humans anymore. Or if it does, the role of the human is much less important than it was. Again, for better or worse.
One of the differences is also that if you ping an archive, you search an archive, normally what you find, you might not be sure of its validity, because that can change within different historical interpretation, but you can be sure of its ontological state of reality in a way. Since it's an archive, it has happened. Someone said this word, someone made this item. That statue is also being challenged now, because you question the validity of the archive itself, because it can give you stuff that never existed and words that were never said.
Well, I suppose maybe where we're at now is just shining a light on the archive to make us realize that that was always the case. You know, there was always fiction in the archive. It's just that we're entering a epistemologically contested period, which is starts to undermine our ontology, or it's like ungrounds the ontology. I mean, I suppose this is what people think about in terms of history of philosophy. Like, as we're in a nihilist period, where facts have, where it's all about perspective. not necessarily relativism, but like maybe this shines a light on the archive has always been composed of like parallel perspectives.
They've always been curated more than...
It's always been curated, yeah. The perspective of the desire of the curator is always inflects the apparent ontology.
How does a label like Hyperdub deal with its own past, memories, historical accounts of now, what, 20 years of activity? Does Hyperdub have an archive? Does Code 9 have an archive?
My memory is an archive in a completely faulty, fallible sense. I don't know. That's a good question. Like, what would an archive of record label be? We don't have like a biography of the label. No one's ever written. There's a few every time we have a birthday, there's some kind of journalistic attempts to like create story of aspects of the label. The label in a way is an amalgam. What is a record label? It's an amalgam of all of these stories and memories and back catalogs and dramas, interpersonal drama. And
I think it has to do also with the materiality of the culture you and all of us are working with, because you could still build some historical accounts of techno, because you can find an old fax that was sent from Detroit to Tresor in Berlin and talking about, oh, if you have this new project called Drexia, and then that's an item perfect for an archive. And in the way probably Hyperdub has been working, you don't have such artifacts anymore. Or maybe you do. I was curious if you keep an archive of those.
There could be an archive of that kind of stuff. There's just not been a historian to pull it together, I suppose. You know, there could be an archive which would consist of the article in the Sun newspaper claiming that Burial was Margaret Thatcher or whatever it was, like Norman Cook or Aphex Twin or whoever. Like you can there's a virtual archive which consists of everything that's ever been written about the label, of all of our every email that's ever been sent internally and externally, of every text message that's been sent between dancers as they come to the nights. You know, there's a virtual archive which is like the extended mind of the label, in a sense. Maybe, you know, the way I've always thought about these things is as a virus. You know, there's a Hyperdub virus, and the virus used me as its main incubator. And I've obviously spread that to people on an interpersonal local level and ended up spreading it to people all over the place. And that virus consisted of local outbreaks in South London, but also outbreaks wherever we've done events. And certain periods in its history, it's gone dormant and it's been less contagious. If you think about it epidemiologically, what is an archive epidemiologically? What is a virus? Well, it's a code with a set of instructions in how something should replicate. And so the archive is the network of that code and the bodies that it's occupied and the digital memories that it is stored in, the analog fleshy memories that it's stored in, and maybe most importantly, its potential. In other words, the bodies that it hasn't yet infected, you know. So the archive is future, or you know, what would the future orientation of that archive be? What is the future orientation of a virus? Well, it's threat that the virus poses, in other words, the bodies that it hasn't yet infected, and most importantly, the mutations it hasn't yet undergone, the dangers that those mutations might pose, the vaccines that haven't yet been invented to deal with those mutations. And
a metaphor which I'm really enchanted by, does it not also in a way divide you, or like place the editorial agency where it's like, oh, I've been just a host of virus? Even the archive I don't curate, it's the virus. Does the virus curate? Because normally virus just wants to replicate.
I think it's a way of escaping agency. Like, it wasn't me, I didn't kill these people. For me, it's a way of understanding that this is part of a wave. You know, for me, this is a way of understanding the relation to the past, that you might do things that are kind of interesting or innovative, but you're also a puppet of something much bigger, and you're possessed by something which is making you do certain things, or which limits your agency, or like delimits your agency. So you, in other words, you can't take credit for everything. You know, you're a carrier. You're a vessel that's carrying certain codes. You can apply those codes and re-permutate these codes, but you're also part of a network which has its own agency, and you're just part of that network. That's a way of working against this idea that you start from a clean slate.
Yeah,
you start from a void and you express your genius into the world, and that changes the world. And opposite of that, it's like you always start in the middle, some sense of possession. You're like you're fully possessed by something which makes you do what you're doing. It might not predetermine what you're doing, but it's still the driving force behind it.
The virus is ancient in a way.
Yeah.
The label catalog isn't that an archive in itself. It's already, it's a result of a curatorial effort of selecting stuff.
Yeah, I look at the back catalog of the label in a very literal sense.
Okay.
And I look at how it's evolved, and I'm like, I just don't, you know, how did it get from there to there? Well, it only got from there to there because I'm open to influence of what the artists wanted, or what's happening in the world, none of which I could have predicted in advance. And I have agency in the sense that I make decisions, you know, that I make curatorial decisions. But the context from which I select, I don't have any control over, really. You know, I curate the context to a certain extent just through having a finite amount of time to look at certain things, through having a set of habits of what kind of music I listen to, what kind of social networks I exist in. You know, there's decisions made in all of these steps. But there's also, you know, the virus idea comes from me trying to come to terms with all the elements in the process that I have no control over at all, and the extent to which I feel out of control or surfing a wave, as opposed to like completely in a cockpit driving something in a direction that I've chosen.
When you're talking about driving or riding a wave, there's an implicit sense of speed in it. That does speed affect all this process?
The beginning of each wave has been accompanied by excitement. And excitement comes from a moment of feeling intensity, of like something really exciting going on. I don't have words to describe it quite yet. It feels different from what we've done before. It feels different to a certain extent from what's going on out in the world, at least the way it resonates with me. And so a sense of like things speeding up. Sometimes that bears in the music, literally. Jungle in the 90s or Footwork more recently. But it doesn't have to be literal speed. It can just be a kind of a feeling of experiential intensification.
You're talking about BPM versus some other energy level, or?
I'm talking about, you know, literally it could be BPMs, or it could be a sense of speeding up in terms of encountering something that you haven't encountered before in rapid succession. And that could be a bunch of producers or a bunch of music that literally forces your perceptual and your cognitive system to speed up, to like catch up with something that you don't have the conceptual equipment to understand. You know, I think you could use synonymous with speed there, kind of intensity or excitation or excitement.
is it the virus making you in a way frantic, like with this velocity, or is it more like the technology you think that's speeding up?
Depends how far you want to zoom out. Clearly, if you look at the last few thousand years, there's been a technologically fueled acceleration of travel, communication, acceleration of population growth, and processor speed. You know, these are kind of very literal ideas of acceleration that are the backdrop to everything. But, you know, in a much closer cycle, at various points of electronic music in the last 40 or so years, there's been moments of literal speed acceleration of BPMs, but then also decelerations. It's like, again, there's a rhythm to it. It seems like a cyclical thing. But then there's this other thing, which I suppose relates to innovation, maybe like cycles of creation, destruction. And when you're in a part of the wave that feels like of innovation, creation, potential, and so on, I think there's a natural feeling. Natural's not the right word. There's a corollary feeling of acceleration there, because there's lots of things happening that you don't understand. So even though it's not necessarily a literal speeding up of rhythms or music, like, I suppose that's what future shock is, having to process things that you don't quite understand, you know. And in terms of musical or form musical innovation, historically, this is often accompanied by what people understand as, what people describe as noise. You know, oh, I don't understand that yet. Oh, it's just noise. And then culturally and cognitively and affectively, you deal with the surprise, the shock of the new, and it gets accommodated, and you start to have language to describe it. And then as you start to have language to describe things and understand that what the formulas are, then there's a accompanying feeling that things slow down. So I think there's a feeling of speed that accompanies not knowing what the fuck's going on.
And also because, like, the human sensorium is limited in the speeds it can perceive. So you can make music that's fast, but you cannot make it faster and faster, because then it becomes, as you said, one single sound, you don't catch rhythms anymore. And the same goes with slowing down, because you start basically severing the relationship between events, and they are not rhythms anymore. You know, the Skynet doesn't know that, doesn't have that limit.